name is Ryan Conrad. I'm from a small town in central Maine, where I've been living for the last 10 years. I've been a part of a queer youth organization called Outright LA, which is a LGBTQ youth drop-in center. It's open once a week. And also do sort of outreach programs, safety trainings with service providers, healthcare people, school teachers to try to create safer, affirming environments for queer and trans youth. And that has sort of informed a lot of the work that I do, is like actually having direct work with queer and trans young people, mostly kids living in poverty in a very Catholic, very small town kind of atmosphere. And that sort of work has really informed and directed a lot of the work that I do above and beyond the actual work in my community. And I'm also the founding member of Against Equality, which is like a sort of online archive, publishing, and arts collective that has been doing work to sort of challenge this idea that we need to be, as queer and trans people, we need to be included in heteronormative institutions and systems like the gay mainstream marriage push and the push to join the US military by overturning Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the problematic hate crimes legislation, which to a lot of us signals a never-ending and always expanding prison industrial complex, which we think actually disproportionately affects queer and trans people. So we're sort of fighting the inclusion in those, or the demand for inclusion in those systems and institutions. I've also been working as an independent artist and ad hoc scholar for the last 3 or 4 years after I finished, or while in grad school and after finishing grad school, making work and stirring up conversations, but not in a particularly strictly art context. Most of my work exists sort of outside of that, if there is an outside of that. And yeah, I've also been living, I think really importantly, I live in a queer collective house in my town in Maine. We've been doing that project for about 6 years, and it's sort of become like a queer beacon, safe house kind of space, where we've been doing a lot of social events as well as having like film showings and dance parties. Sort of some sort of like lecture style stuff, but yeah, primarily like cultural and social queer stuff in a town that doesn't have a queer meeting point. There is no gay bar.
Can you speak to me about Against Equality and perhaps starting with the choosing of this name, which is a very incendiary name when it comes to gay politics in this country, and maybe also reflecting upon the idea of equality as it has been constructed as the pillar of gay politics in America?
Yeah, I mean, it has, the Against Equality Project has direct, I mean, so I'm the founding member, so it's sort of like, this thing was my idea, and it sort of like grew from this original project that was very personal, geo-specific, and how it started was, it was a blog that I started around, in 2009, the gay marriage referendum went to vote in Maine, and I was really pissed off and angry about how the campaign was being run and the sort of like sapping of resources from everything else in the state that had like any other queer thing in the state or trans thing in the state. Like all money, all energy, volunteer hours were being whipped away to this like single issue campaign that in all honesty wasn't going to solve a lot of the problems that people in somehow in their imagination thought it was going to solve. For example, like the issue of healthcare, like people were like, oh, well, if people can get married, they can share their healthcare and, or health insurance. I think that's an important distinction to make between health insurance and healthcare. But people were talking about, oh, we can share health insurance if we get married. And the reality of it is working class people don't have health insurance through their work, like myself. And if I got married to either of my lovers, like I still wouldn't have health insurance because they don't either. So it was sort of like this sham that was being sold to poor people all across the state, particularly like poor queer and trans people across the state, that like this thing was gonna help them in some way. And I just like, I didn't believe it. And the campaign in Maine specifically was run by Equality Maine, which identifies itself as like the gay and lesbian activist organization in the state, but the only thing they do is gay marriage. They don't actually do anything else. And they have a huge budget. It's like nonprofit industrial complex, like to a T. And yeah, so I started this project to sort of like point some of those things out. And I wrote this essay called Against Equality in Maine and Everywhere. And that essay sort of was showing in a very material sense, like what the effects of this gay marriage campaign in Maine was doing and like where the resources were going, where the money was coming from, how it was being spent. And comparing that to two documents that had come out the year before and that year, one being the Maine Equity Fund put on the symposium in 2008 and had stakeholders from all over the state, LGBTQ identified, that came up with, you know, like priorities for the next 10 years of what we should be working on as a community. And marriage is mentioned twice in the like executive summary that, you know, sums up this 2-day symposium. And marriage is mentioned twice, and once it's mentioned as part of like a comprehensive set of like family law changes that we should be pushing towards. And the other was mentioned by the Queer Youth Caucus, who said they were tired of how much space gay marriage was taking up in the sort of like gay political arena in Maine. So it's interesting that like queer youth voices were totally ignored, as well as like this entire document created by people from all across the state that said like, you know, all like it's 2.5 page executive summary and the only thing that's being done is one bullet point under one section, and it's getting millions and millions and millions of dollars. So that was really frustrating to me, as well as there was a poll put out by the Family Affairs newsletter, which is run by queer and trans folks in the Bangor area. So it's about 2.5-3 hours north of where I live, so it's pretty far up. Which put out a poll, and it's something like 63% of the respondents said gay marriage was not a priority for them. And it was something like 32-33% said it was their last priority in terms of the issues that needed to be worked on in the state in a gay and trans context. So I felt like the community was being ignored. There were sort of these professional activists that were working for these professional gay and lesbian organizations that were, you know, getting funding from different sources, so they were doing sort of whatever was on the national agenda. And that really pissed me off, and the campaign was run so poorly. The idea was to just get out the vote in the liberal parts of the state, which basically meant along the coast, where there is money and liberals, and basically abandon the rest of the state, and that's where I live. And it basically created an opportunity for all this homophobic fervor to be like out in the open with no one to challenge it. And the only places it was being challenged were places where it didn't need to be challenged, or it didn't need to be just challenged as drastically as it did where I live. So that was super frustrating. I felt like these people in Portland were stirring up a bunch of shit, and I had to deal with it. Like, I had to be the one dealing with the queer and trans kids coming to our drop-in center that felt totally destroyed after the referendum had failed. Like, we had to pick up, like, it's the people that were actually doing the work that had to pick up all the pieces, as opposed to these like high-paid professional class gay and lesbians that live in an area where they don't, like, there's a greater level of acceptance and there isn't as big of a need for services. And then I think about, okay, like, what about the rest of the state that, like, there is nothing for queer and trans people? There's basically been, like, this massive platform for homophobia, like, on the airways, on the TV, on the radio, in print, in the newspaper. Like, there's, like, all this homophobic, anti-queer stuff coming out, and there's no one to push back against it in these communities. And so it was basically, like, an urban-centric campaign that totally abandoned queer people all across the state by stirring up all this shit and then not actually being around to, like, knock on doors and, you know, actually have community dialogue about the issue. So that's how the project started, was with that essay and sort of, like, making a lot of noise around the actual campaign in Maine, because it's, I don't think Maine is exemplary, or is special or something. It's like, this is the same model that's used all over the place. Like Maryland, Rhode Island, Washington State, Oregon State, I know they're next on the national agenda to get different blocks of states to approve gay marriage. And that sort of works as a strategy. Like, the idea is to get blocks of states to approve gay marriage and then have those blocks of states pressure the federal government to push it on a federal level. So it's sort of this like chess game where Maine got used as a pawn in a larger national agenda for gay marriage, and that totally ignored the actual local needs in the state.
Can you explain politically why you think the gay and lesbian organizations have been fixating so much on this issue of gay marriage, as opposed to addressing some of the needs? And I want to ask you what those needs are also, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably a lot of things going on. I won't pretend to know, like, all of them, but I think a large part of it has to do with the professionalization of gay and lesbian activist organizations into, like, sort of career, nonprofit, like high-paying jobs. And within the nonprofit sector, you're answerable to your funders. Like, you do what your funders actually want you to do. So there's sort of like this hierarchy of the people with money still get to decide what happens. And I think with Equality Maine, this was a perfect example. They hosted a series of community dialogues where they showed up, and I actually went to one even though it's like, oh, it's Equality Maine, I'm not going to agree with anything they have to say. But I was like, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that this is actually going to be a community dialogue, right? So I go, and it was like a presentation on how they were going to win gay marriage. They didn't ask any questions. They like had a flip chart, and they were like, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to win, and this is like what we're going to do if it goes to referendum. And I was like, this isn't a community dialogue, you know, like, what, like, how did we get here? Like, we didn't ask the questions yet. And I think that comes from like a super professionalized, like, the NGLTF is going to give you $100,000 to work on gay marriage. And I can tell you, it continues, like, and people just don't listen, but it continues because GLAAD, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, based in Boston, applied for grants to the Maine Community Foundation's Equity Fund to do gay marriage advocacy in Maine. So it's like these people from Boston were coming to Maine, like, just people just don't listen. Like, okay, why don't you ask people what they want instead of like coming from out of state, trying to sap local resources to do what you want to do? Like that, I mean, that's what continues to happen. And I think it's because, yeah, it's like the nonprofit industrial complex. We've got career activists that are answerable to their funders. And what do funders want? Like, who's giving that money? It's upper class, professional class gays that want to consolidate power, privilege, and property through this thing we call marriage.
It seems like you are underlying a certain kind of class critique on the way that the politics are being built.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, and getting back to Against Equality a little bit, I think that it's hugely what it's about. For us, it's a materialist class critique. And to actually talk about marriage, like, to sort of wipe away this, like, gloss of affect that people have been portraying marriage as, like, you know, this is about love, this is about family. And it's like, actually, no, this is about, like, a social contract between two people in the state and how it transfers property, power, and money between them. And I think it's really hard for people to step back from the sort of sheen that has been put over marriage. And, you know, gay and lesbian activists have been doing that, like, have been, like, digging up this rhetoric of affect and love and, like, oh, we, like, how can you outlaw love? And it's like, actually, that's not what anyone's talking about. You know, like, that is sort of the it's like the distraction from like what's actually going on and like actually talking about how this like decides whether people live or die, like whether people have access to healthcare or not, whether people have access to move across borders, whether people have access to jobs, and people aren't talking about that piece. So yeah, like the class critique is huge, and for me that also comes from like a sort of rural urban critique as well. Like not to suggest there aren't poor people in urban settings, but in Maine in particular, like rural equals poverty where I live. So for me, it also comes from like, okay, there's like these urban gays that have more money than the rest of us, like sort of setting the agenda. Meanwhile, like people outside of major urban centers don't have access to like any resources and are most at risk for, poverty, HIV, like it's pretty ridiculous like how urban centric the conversation has become, and part of that for me is like the class critique.
What are the needs when you speak about the real needs? Can you enumerate those needs in relation? I mean, I imagine it's different in different places, but
yeah, totally. I mean, it's geospecific, and I also think it's different for different parts of the community. Like this idea that like I feel like we can't talk about the gay and lesbian community or the queer and trans community as like this single monolithic thing, right? Like everyone's like this idea that it's a community even is kind of problematic, suggesting like based on like sexual identity characteristics like that we'll have things in common, where sort of we have like these multiple identities, intersubjectivity, like we're not just queer, but we're also, we also have a class, a race, an ethnicity, like an ability, a citizenship status. So I think it, I think it's complicated to say, oh, like these are the needs. But I think going through processes like the Maine Community Foundation's Equity Funds Symposium, where you actually bring people from all over the state for like 2 days to actually hash out, okay, what, like what should our community's priorities be? I guess I'm more hesitant to say like what the priorities are than to talk about what the processes should look like to get to those priorities. And I think that document is super valuable in Maine, and I hope other places are doing similar things where, you know, like a community organization can get the funding to make a free conference, can provide sliding scale housing, and can provide travel reimbursement to get people from all over the state to have these conversations. So it's not just people with resources and money who can take time off from work and can travel and can like pay for a hotel. And I guess the question too, like specifically with marriage, I think more than saying like, okay, marriage shouldn't be a priority, but we should be providing X, Y, and Z, is saying, okay, well, what does marriage do? And for me, it's like a material need. Like marriage gives you access to healthcare in certain circumstances. It gives you access to moving across borders in certain circumstances. So I think it's like, okay, like let's figure out what like these material benefits of marriage are and figure out how everyone can access those things without necessarily being compelled to marry. Like everyone should be able to access healthcare. And then I think the other piece of it too is the affect piece. Like, okay, like what are our community's affective needs? Like what does marriage do in terms of affect? Like it suggests that like our relationships are valid, or suggests that like the state condones our love or something like that. And I think the desire for that is something that needs to be reckoned with. I don't think that's something that we can write off. And I think it stems from like a long history of homophobia and transphobia and violence against queer and trans people that, yeah, like seeking out some sort of validation and respect from the world as to like our relationships and our humanity is really important. I don't think marriage is the way to do that, obviously, but sort of asking that question, so like what is the affective needs and what are the material needs of our community and how do we meet them without sublimating ourselves to church and state is like the question for me. And I don't think my answer is particularly exciting or interesting. I think it's about like that community dialogue about addressing that question of affective and material needs.
Does against equality play a role outside of a kind of discursive critique in the field of activism? In other words, are you thinking of ways of implementing political strategy and perhaps virally influencing the way that some of these organizations are running their agendas?
I feel like we're too disorganized at this point. I mean, there's been talk of like setting up conference call lines and whatnot because, yeah, we're spread out. Like, I live in small town Maine. The co-editor of the book lives in Chicago. Contributing members live across the United States and Canada. So it's kind of a ragtag group of people doing lots of things. And I think it's important to remember, too, that Against Equality isn't really an organization. Like, we primarily exist as an archive. And not that the archive doesn't have, like, political potential or something to, like, impact or influence. And that, like I was saying, like, I mean, my primary commitment is to Outright LA, because that's the, like, direct material thing in my community where I feel like I have a big impact. So I think it's important to remember that, like, Against Equality is, like, this extra thing that a bunch of us do on the side. As opposed to like, okay, like Against Equality is this like primary organization where we're gonna like have like a phone tree and structure and whatever. Like it's sort of been pretty ad hoc for the last year and a half. And, you know, we've been talking about changing that a little bit to like do bigger projects to like impact more people. But in terms of like how we influence, like say the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force or the HRC or something, I think we do do it to some effect in terms of getting people to divest from those organizations. For example, like our logo is the greater than sign that's in yellow with a blue background, which is like a playoff of the HRC's equal signs, which is in the same color, which is their logo. So our logo is sort of saying greater than, or some logo saying equal. And then, sort of playing off of, I think we a lot, the group of us like to play with semiotics and like sort of older symbols and then reappropriating them and changing them. Like the recent Just Say No to Marriage, which is a playoff of Nancy Reagan's Just Say No to Drugs. Like her image is actually trademarked, so I don't know if we'll get in trouble. We changed it a little bit. But you know, like playing off of those kind of things. And I sort of see our role more cultural in trying to create more space for those conversations than it is to like actually become like some sort of political organization. And I think on top of that too, we're skeptical of a lot of the structures of sort of like nonprofit political action groups in terms of like, we don't think it's wrong for people to get paid. We actually think that's really important to value people's labor and work, coming from a class critique. But just thinking about how a lot of nonprofits get co-opted and like end up being pushed towards this model of like, you know, you're answerable to your funders. You gotta like have professional activists, career activists on your board. And, like, just like a sort of direction we're not interested in going. Like the fact that we aren't that makes us like a lot more fluid and quick to react to things and a lot more autonomy.
Are you in conversation with any historical organizations or not necessarily official organizations in the United States that may have influenced the way that you're operating as a collective and the type of work that you are producing?
Yeah, I mean, some people that have contributed to the project are also part of Gay Shame in San Francisco, which also functions like a collective, pretty ad hoc, open meetings. But that's sort of that like collective structure where people bring what they have to the table and the group makes decisions from there on a consensus model structure. I think the group Le Gay, Queer Insurrection, also based in the Bay Area, has sort of been around since, I think it's the early 80s. And they've been publishing the newsletter Ultraviolet. And like we've shared our work in their newspaper and they're super friendly with us. So I think there's groups that different people in Against Equality have relationships to, like personal relationships or activist relationships to. Like Yasmin in Chicago is like working with Gender Just, used to be in Queer to the Left. So I feel like we all have different groups that we've been a part of or are in dialogue with that we sort of bring to the table, but aren't it's not necessarily like a official sort of relationship or coalition.
I find it interesting that in the wake of the sexual liberation movement, the type of critique that you are articulating today was the norm, or at least it was much more present. Yeah. And I'm interested in understanding from your perspective as an activist and a collective, what happened? What was that process of normalization like in the last 30 years? To the extent that the critique that you are posing today is that of a minority, and perhaps even frowned upon by most LGBT or maybe LGB people.
I think Yasmin and I talk about this in a bit about the essay that we've done for the journal that you're working on, but talking about sort of like the trajectory of like first with gay liberation and then HIV epidemic, people dying, and the Christian right like responding in full force, and then antiretrovirals and like, okay, like we've been punished for our like sexual liberation, like now we need to like slow it down and get back to reality and, you know, settle down and you know, like ACT UP has this like sort of like funny, dark, sad component to it that a lot of people never talk about, which is, you know, like ACT UP used to like push for universal healthcare, like that was the norm, like there was protests all the time for universal healthcare, and sort of like as ACT UP was fizzling out in the mid to late 90s, there were ACT UP chapters like aggressively pushing a gay marriage agenda, And no one seems to talk about that, which, I mean, it's fine. Like, Active also did a lot of amazing things, but, you know, it wasn't perfect, whatever. Like, I'm not trying to suggest that we need to, like, valorize it as perfect, but, yeah, I think there's just been, like, this cultural conservative shift that came from, both the right-wing backlash in the 80s and 90s to, like, yeah, a lot of death. I mean, it's hard, because I also didn't live it. Like, I'm 27, so, you know, I'm inheriting this history, and I have very few, or up until recently, I've had very few older queer mentors. Like, I actually had to work really hard to, like, meet older queers that were involved in ACT UP, or Queer to the Left, or, you know, any of these organizations that, more radical organizations that were pushing the same sort of ideological stance that is similar to the one that Against Equality has. Like, it's been really difficult to find those people, and especially being small town or not from, like, New York City or San Francisco or something like that. Like, it's pretty difficult. And I think that's huge. Like, I think, like, not having historical context, like, no one teaches queer history. You can't take a queer history class in high school. Like, you can barely take them in a college or university course. And I think that's huge. Like, queers have to teach themselves all their own history, which is a lot of work, and it's really hard. I mean, maybe it's getting easier. Like, the internet, we didn't have the internet when I was in high school, but now everyone seems to have some sort of access to it, or at least most people do, in the States. So, yeah, I think there's, like, a huge gap in knowing our own histories, and it's scary, because, like, I think about the kids in my program in Outright LA, who, you know, gay marriage has been the agenda for the last almost 10 years, and they know nothing but a gay marriage agenda, like, as if, like, that was what gay liberation was actually gay marriage, because there's no context, there's no history to it, and that scares the hell out of me, that, like, people don't know. And I think, and again, that's, like, a priority for me, why I work with Outright LA, is, like, I can be, like, one of those older queer mentors that can be, like, oh, you don't know about Marsha P. Johnson, or, oh, you don't know about Sylvia Rivera, let me tell you, like, you don't know Jean Genet, like, you know, I can share those stories and, like, point them to books or videos that, you know, could interest them, and sort of, like, show culturally this other way of organizing your life or approaching the political landscape. I think an important question to ask too is, like, okay, like, why is there this historical amnesia or this, like, historical gap? And for me, one of them is the prison industrial complex and the criminalization of intergenerational queer relationships, particularly between men. The fact that, like queer men are, like, anytime there's, like, an intergenerational relationship, like, the fear of being labeled a pedophile or, like, a sexual predator sort of, like, cuts off the possibilities for those kind of relationships, even if they are non-sexual. So it's, like, the prison industrial complex, which is, like, what we're trying to expand through hate crimes legislation. So it's, like, kind of this, like, vicious circle. But so it's, like, okay, yeah, there's, like, the criminalization of intergenerational relationships, and there's also, like, thousands of dead people who can't speak for themselves. And I guess with the internet, there's more access to those voices historically. But yeah, when I was in high school, it was like 98. Like, I didn't have access to any of that.
I understand that one of the books that you're going to publish is on the prison and the hate crime legislation. Can you expand on this? And what is the work that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is the most complicated piece, or, like, the least... Like, people are like, yeah, fuck the military, and yeah, fuck marriage, like, we're anti-assimilationists, but then it's like, wait, we're against hate crimes legislation and, like, protections? Like, that doesn't seem right. But part of the critique for us is that the prison industrial complex, like, actually doesn't solve problems, it compounds them and makes them worse, and is putting people in prison actually challenging or fixing the harm that's happening in our communities or against our community? And usually the answer, most people are like, oh yeah, like, actually like, it's not the Department of Justice, it's the Department of Corrections or whatever, you know, it's like, this isn't about justice, this is about locking people up and forgetting. There's no, like, rehabilitation, there's no, you know, work to actually make sure there's, like, a restorative justice practice. Like, that doesn't exist, right? Like, it's penalization, it's not rehabilitation. So for us, it's like, okay, like maybe investing in the prison industrial complex as a means to protect our community isn't a great idea. Like maybe that's not actually going to solve problems. I think it's also important to remember like how surveillance and policing functions in queer and trans communities presently and historically. The prison industrial complex and how it surveils people definitely disproportionately affects queer and trans people.
Can you explain that a bit more in depth?
Yeah, I mean, it's around this idea that queer and trans people not always having access to employment because there are no non-discrimination laws in place. So particularly trans people having more difficulties with employment and doing sex work as a means of being able to meet their basic material needs. Trans sex workers have been profiled. So even if you're not a trans sex worker, but you're a trans person walking down the street, you can be arrested for solicitation. Like it happens, folks in Gay Shame have been working on this in San Francisco. So there's this whole like criminalization of trans identity. Like you can get arrested being like trans walking down the street, is what sometimes people call it. Or like standing on a corner being trans can get you arrested for solicitation. So there's sort of like this criminalization and policing of queer and trans communities, particularly of trans people, particularly trans people of color, who are disproportionately being placed in prison. And this is even shown through, there are new, it's both in the United States and Canada, they're trying to build what they call gender responsive prisons. So they're trying to like deal with this trans issue and deal with gender non-conforming people. And try to teach them how to like appropriately act their gender, like prisons that would have like manners for women, you know, like that would actually be like part of their rehabilitation. So that's sort of where we're coming from. Is like actually this thing, not only does it not solve our problem, but it actually criminalizes broad segments of our community.
With both the critique that you pose on gay marriage and the critique that you've just mentioned, it seems to me that what you're trying to get at, it's actually quite complicated because it's a systemic change. It's not necessarily tackling those specific things, but actually looking at the way that this country institutionally has framed these debates.
Yeah, and correct? That comes back to like the name of Against Equality, right? Like we're actually suggesting this idea of equality in the status quo of the systems and institutions that already exist that were designed for a heterosupremacist society and a classist society and a racist society, like maybe aren't where we should be investing our energy, and that we should be looking to sort of transformative or imagine, like even allowing ourselves to imagine like transformative ways of, you know, dealing with the issue of meeting our material and affective needs, dealing with harm and violence in our community, or, you know, dealing with whatever this idea of like nationhood and national security are. When we talk about equality, we're talking about this idea that we need to have equal stake in these hugely problematic, and I'd even say deadly, institutions, and suggesting that we're against that. And, you know, some people at some of the events that we've done have been like, oh, well, you're not like against equality, you're just like, you're for real equality, you're just against like this sham of equality. And I was like, yeah, I guess like if that's how you need to frame it to yourself to like get what we're saying, yeah, like that's right. Like we're for like radical equity, right? That's like actually what we're saying. We're talking about economic justice and social justice on a huge broad scale, and not just simply like single issue identity politics that, yeah, none of us feel invested in.
It seems like a fairly impossible project to accomplish in this country, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, people are like, oh, you guys are just utopic. And I'm like, of course we are. Like, why would you be anything less? Like, why do you set your goals so low, or your vision? You know, like, utopia is not a place, we're not going to get to it, but it's like a process, it's a way of envisioning a future. And I think it's important not to lose that. Like, people are so like, oh, we need to be like pragmatic, like marriage is the winnable thing, we can do this. And I'm like, that's so ideological and ridiculous. Like, why would you compromise like a vision of like the way the world that you want to live in, why would you compromise that for like crumbs from the table of a table you don't want to sit at? And I get really frustrated with like the this concept of gay pragmatism, like, oh, we just have to be pragmatic and incremental change. I'm like, incremental change towards what? A world that sucks, you know, like a world that's like totally classist and racist and hetero supremacist. Like, I'm not working towards that.
I find that the frame, I mean, a queer critique of these systemic issues is super important. And I wonder if you are in communication with other minority groups, such as immigrants and others, and racial groups and others that are dealing with similar issues yet from a different perspective. Is there some kind of reconciliation amongst these groups, or there is a layer of homophobia that is sometimes embedded to other communities that may separate it?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no at the same time. Like it's important to remember that, like, multifaceted, like, intersubjective, like, we aren't just queer, but some of the people in the group are queer immigrants and are queer people of color. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that their experience within, like, people of color communities or immigrant communities, like, doesn't experience homophobia in those environments, but to remember that maybe we're not, like, in coalition with specific organizations or something, but that individual members from our group are parts of those other communities. And, you know, I think it's something that was said at the Palestinian queer activist talk last night sort of resonated with me and this other group that I've worked with once in a while called Nutty North. Nutty North says, like, we're going to create a queer presence at radical activist events, and we're going to create a radical presence at queer activist events. And sort of, they were talking about that last night. It's sort of like, okay, like, yeah, like, let's create a queer presence at the immigration rally and make sure that we have a pro-immigrant stance at the queer rally, right? Like, so we, like, combine the two and make sure that we're doing a both and instead of an either or. And I think that's sort of like a normal operating procedure for most people that are associated with the project. It's sort of like, yeah, like, this is about everything through a queer lens.
This reminds me, in the 1970s, in different contexts, the socialist, but the Marxist-Leninist or Marxist-Maoist movements and the sexual liberation movement were working together for the most part. But then it came to a point in which the socialists would, I wouldn't say all of them, but most of them were claiming that homosexuality was a product of capitalism. Yeah. So there was a break between the organizations. This reminds me a bit of that. And I wonder how much of that kind of radical left, conservative radical left legacy we carry on to the future.
Like, the radical left in the United States doesn't really exist.
Right.
So it's like, oh, okay, well, it's hard to talk about them when they're no longer, like, that world doesn't exist, it feels like. But yeah, I think that's true. Like, I think...
Not in an organized way, but it does exist in microcosms.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, like post-gender, post-sexuality. Like, I feel like it's gone so far post-structuralist that the sort of worlds where people... The people that are sort of inheriting that left radical American political history are sort of at, like, a post-gender, post-sexuality place, which I find, like, super problematic, right? Like I agree, like, gender is, like, this social construction, and, you know, it's, like, a spectrum, and people aren't one or the other, or they're somewhere, or, like, you know, like, no one's gay, no one's straight, we're all just sexual. Like, I get all that. Like, that makes sense to me, and sure, I believe it. But at the same time, it doesn't acknowledge the, like, material conditions. Like, yeah, you're so post-sexual, but you're in, like, a heterosexual relationship, and I'm not, and that can get me killed. So you're like, you might be over it, but guess what? The Christian right's not, you know? Like, the Christian right's not post-sexuality or post-gender. So I feel like there's some pushback that needs to happen in sort of, like, the left intellectual circles that have sort of, like, you know, like, everyone's, like, beyond gender or beyond sexuality or beyond marriage. I'm like, you can't just be beyond it, because you got to be against it at the same time. And I know that's a paradox to, like, sort of, like, okay, we have to, like, fight this thing and actually, like, be ideologically past it at the same time. Sort of sets you up in this paradox of, like, how do you be against and beyond something simultaneously? Like, you have to challenge this thing because, like, you know, the gay marriage movement is actually killing people, right? It's, like, actually taking funding away from groups like Yasmin, we can tell you about Gender Just, like, they actually got denied grants because they weren't working on gay marriage. You know, this is like a queer youth of color organization being told, sorry, we're not going to fund your work for, like, demilitarizing your schools and making them safer. You know, so, like, how can you be beyond that Like, if you're beyond that, you're not addressing it. So it's like, okay, we actually have to challenge this monster as well as, like, be ideologically, like, post this thing. And I think that's a really hard thing for people to get. And I think that's, like, where, again, coming back to the name of Against Equality, it's, like, really hard for people to get it that we're, like, not telling people not to get married. Like, you want to get married, whatever. Like, do whatever you gotta do, right? Like, I don't care, you know? But it's, like, you need to, like, challenge and think about this, like, institution and how it works to, like, mark some bodies as worthy of living and others as not. Like, you can't just be, like, beyond that. And that's, like, I know some people would know, like, the Beyond Marriage statement that came out in the early 2000s. Like, I'm sort of referencing that. I think it was a really important moment, but I think it's problematic in the way that we're, like, beyond this thing that's, like, has huge material repercussions, including death.
How have you guys collectively been thinking about Don't Ask, Don't Tell? And what is your position about the recent success of removing it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. People are so wrapped up in it. And it's problematic because some people have this, like, weird, this is economic justice. Like, this is going to help queer people in poor rural communities in the Midwest, like, have access to job security. I'm like, that's the most fucked up thing to say. Like, someone's job security is dependent on, like, whether they're part of this imperialist war machine that's putting their lives at risk and people of color's lives at risk all over the planet. Like, that's not economic justice. Like, what planet are you people on? And I think Queers for Economic Justice, like, put out a really great statement about how, you know, like, a military job is not economic justice. Like, this is a total farce. And I think anyone that's convinced themselves that our military is designed to, like, defend and protect the United States is, like, that's a sham. That's a total lie. And I don't know, like, who sold you that or, like, how you bought it hook, line, and sinker, but that's not what the U.S. Army does. Like, it's an imperialist army. And Matilda Bornstein, Sycamore Bornstein, talks about it, too, in some of her... she was talking with Dan Choi on Democracy Now! About, you know, like, we could actually solve the social issues of poverty in small communities by taking, like, a tenth of the war budget and actually putting it into social programming so people don't have the, I either join the military or I live in poverty dichotomy. I think the whole thing's so problematic.
How did he respond? Do you remember?
Dan Choi? Some weird, like, it didn't make any sense. I was, like, not following him, but he was like, oh, you know, but it would be even more righteous to take the moral high ground if you had the choice to choose not to go to the army or to go to the army. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, that's not talking about, like, dealing with the issue of poverty. Like, he was trying to make some, like, moralist, humanist argument about how it's more meaningful when you make the choice not to rather than not have the choice. Which I think is totally irrelevant.
It seems to me that a lot of these things, and this is something I wonder about often, is why so many of these issues are framed around the kind of primacy of respecting an identity, an individual identity, yeah, to be more precise, as opposed to a collective identity.
Yeah, I mean, basically, like, individual gay rights has trumped human rights on a global scale. And I think people forget to frame it or step back and, like, put it in a more global perspective that, like, okay, now we have gays in the military, like, great, your identity is honored as military personnel. However, like, it still doesn't address the fact that, like, human rights on a global scale don't matter to the U.S. military. So it's like, okay, yeah, it's like this huge collective, like, the whole damn planet, the collective is, you know, thrown out the window for this, like, hyper-American individualistic identity-based right of being able to have a choice to join the army. So it's like, yeah, individual, American individualism versus, like, the world.
Actually, I wouldn't call it American individualism because I don't think it's specific to this country. Mm-hmm. I think it's specific to the way LGBT politics have been constructed in a kind of international model.
Yeah.
Which may be spinning up from the United States.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, maybe I'm not totally invested in figuring out the origins, but I feel like, yeah, like, when I was in Cape Town and when I was in Johannesburg in South Africa, like, it was Western European American gay culture in Africa. It's like, this doesn't make any sense. It was like the same bad music, the same bad clothes, the same bad hair, like shoes. Like, it was like I was in Chelsea, but I was in Cape Town. It didn't make any sense, right? So like, there's this globalization of gay culture, and I think you're right. I think it's that type of like individualistic, rights-based gay and lesbian politic that's like been replicated globally. But I also think there's interesting people contesting that sort of political landscape being transferred onto them.
Like whom?
I mean, for example, the Palestinian queer activists last night were talking about, like, you can't just take the Western context and dump it in the Middle East. It doesn't work. You know, like, so those people, it's Aswat and Al-Qais, I think, were the two groups speaking last night, like, really eloquently about, like, yeah, you can't just pick it up and move it somewhere else.
One of the things that is interesting, going back to the idea of this focus on the individual, is how, in a way, it feels to me that there is a kind of internalized homophobia when you think only of the individual, because it's really about going back to the family structure and this idea of needing to be accepted within that family and having to kind of shape your life around the presets of that of the family nucleus or the society or the school or the work. And I'm actually not quite sure of what I'm saying, but I think there is an element there that needs to be reconsidered.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, I think I could even point to a local example for myself. As you know, like, the proliferation of this idea of the gay prom. Like, When I was in high school, we were like, fuck the prom! And, like, we'd all go, like, all the queers and the weirdos and the punks would go do something else, like, totally fun and, like, not the prom. And now there's, like, gay proms everywhere. Like, kids have gay prom, or, like, kids fight so that the gay couple can be the king and king or the queen and queen of the prom or whatever. And yeah, I feel like there's this loss of like, fuck you, we don't need to be included in this fucked up bullshit. We can do our own thing. Like, there's no pushback. I guess it comes back to that like demand for inclusion. There's just like, we want our individuality recognized and included in this thing, as opposed to like, be like, yeah, we're different. Fuck it, we're gonna do our own thing and be our own people and do whatever we want and not seek that affirmation from the thing that like you think is messed up in the first place. So I feel like that shift has definitely happened like since the late 90s when I was in high school to present. It's like there's less of that pushback of like, no, fuck you, we're gonna do our own thing. We don't need your affirmation to a desperate, desperate push for, like, affirmation and inclusion.
Well, it seems to me that the last time it happened in this country, and not only in the queer world, but in general, in terms of a social movement, was with the AIDS crisis. Because there was a real sense of urgency and a threat of death and a sense of collectively organizing to battle something that was affecting the community so radically. Not only the gay and lesbian community. But it seems like there is no urgency anymore. And that's something that I'm really struck by. And that's why I'm interested in your work, because you're pointing to the urgency that is still there but has been completely instrumentalized under a rhetoric that is ignoring that urgency. So there is no sense of organization, there is no sense of collectivity, there is no sense of building a social movement. That's something that it's really terrifying, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the only thing that seems like there's like a cohesion and movement around is these national, like the gay marriage campaigns, which, yeah, like have this, I think for people that's like the rallying cry is like gay marriage, and like it feels like there's a community building around it, but it's not real. I don't think it's real at all. Like it's a lot of money being poured in from like certain groups of people to make certain other groups of people volunteer all night for like a piece of pizza or something, you know, like that's the context of it. But yeah, I mean, it feels like the queer left and the left in general just like doesn't exist. And I think maybe part of it is like, is fatigue. Yeah, it's hard to be putting up the fight all the time. Like, I definitely feel that because I feel like Yasmin and I have become sort of the more public face of Against Equality, and like, we started getting death threats from people after I gave a lecture in Georgetown Yeah, like it's hard to be on the front lines all the time, I think.
What kind of death threats?
I'll chop you up into little pieces and throw you in a dumpster, you fucking faggot, blah blah blah.
Yeah. Coming from other, gay people
other,
or from
other gay people, yeah. Yeah, there was one week where Yasmin and I both received like 3 or 4 death threats on Facebook.
Well, because you're messing up with the most precious things of gay people.
I know. People just want to get married.
No, well, I actually think the most precious thing is Lady Gaga, because didn't you say that she was evil?
No, it totally came after the Lady Gaga thing, for sure. Yeah, but I mean, like, she's, like, an example of, like, that, like, that's activism to people now. It's, like, you become a pop star and then you, like, make a statement about something. You know, like, you don't actually do the work. You just, like, stand on the stage and you're a puppet.
So what is the path to this transformation that you're advocating for?
Yeah, I mean, that's like the question. Like, I feel like when we've done events, like everyone's like, okay, like what do we do? Like what happens next? Like we're on board. This stuff's not good, you know? And then everyone's like, okay, well what happens next? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what happens next. Like, I'm trying not to, I don't want that to be a cop-out, to be like, oh, well, I don't know, like, that's the conversation we need to be having, which I do believe is true. Like, I think if, like, Conrad or the Against Equality Collective was like, all right, here's, like, the 6-point strategy to, you know, gay utopia, like, we'd be just as bad as Equality Maine or the HRC or any of those other orgs that, like, do the same thing, right? Like, we actually are saying, like, we shouldn't actually do that. But I don't want that to be a cop-out to say, like, oh, like, I don't have any ideas, you know? Like, I feel like this is also very true in the art world where people are like, oh, I want to explore this or I want to raise questions. And it's like, well, okay, well, people actually need answers too. Like, people actually need to hear what you think and then push back or work with it. I mean, like, in terms of the collective, I think our priority and our goal has been to, like, create propaganda and material around this idea of neoliberalism and inclusion within the heteronormative or heterosupremacist world. And so our main objective has been to create space to, like, actually have these conversations, which I think we've achieved that goal. Like, I think it's been really great. We've sold over 800 books in the last 6 months, and we've been touring and lecturing. I'm going to be on the West Coast for 3 weeks in April. And I think we're achieving that goal and opening up dialogue, which feels really important. Like, we're not just artists and we're not just academics or something writing something and then putting it out into the world and not having conversations about it. Like, we've actually been doing events and, like, having community dialogue.
Well, artists and academics also do that.
it's true, but I feel like that doesn't yeah, always happen, right? Like, you can't just, like, make something and put it out in the world and then walk away, which I feel like happens a lot. So to actually, like, go out and, like, try to have discussions is really important. And I think that is doing some of that community building work of, like, actually getting a bunch of people that are not sure, confused, maybe a little suspicious of, like, mainstream gay politics together in a room and to, like, give them, to basically give them, like, the historical context of from where we're coming from and to be able to, like, put in their back pocket, you know, like, a bunch of ammo to actually have conversations within their own communities as well with, you know, not a bunch of like-minded people. I think that's been really important. I think that is sort of trying to create that groundswell of people that are suspicious and that can actually, like, have those conversations in geospecific context to be able to say, okay, like, we don't like this. Like, we sort of are on the same page. We have similar critiques. Like, then being able to figure out what the next steps are, whether it's to, like, start in another organizations to start an art collective, to do a video project, whatever. And I guess for me, it's like coming back to my own community and figuring out, okay, like, what do I need to be doing here? And for me, it's always come back to youth work, like working with young people. And that's been my priority. And I think that for me, it's from, like, not having had, like, I grew up in a very conservative naval town. Like, I didn't know any gay people till I moved to Maine. Which is a pretty big deal, because there's not as many gays in Maine. But yeah, so I don't know, like, what the next steps are specifically, but for me it's like, okay, like, I'm going to work really hard to, like, be a mentor to young people and to, like, make sure young people have access to queer history, and hope that that sort of, like, builds another next generation of activists and queer kids that are, you know, not necessarily going to jump on board with mainstream gay and lesbian like identity politics. Mm. In terms of like what a national or like global movement would look like, I don't know.